Cambridge International Examinations, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June Examination Session, 2014. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. What is the new reading book going to be all about?
Now, everyone, we are going to study a new book for the end-of-term examination.
Is it going to be another 19th century novel?
No, we're going to study a more modern book. The famous author Suzette Wilson wrote it in 1975, which I know might seem a long time ago to you, but its main theme, being part of a large family, is really interesting for us all, even in 2014. It's funny, and I think you're all going to enjoy it. Now, everyone, we are going to study a new book for the end-of-term examination.
Is it going to be another 19th century novel?
No, we're going to study a more modern book. The famous author Suzette Wilson wrote it in 1975, which I know might seem a long time ago to you, but its main theme, being part of a large family, is really interesting for us all, even in 2014. It's funny, and I think you're all going to enjoy it.
Question 2. Which two pieces of information does Marcus need so that he can change the customer's order?
Online help desk here. Marcus speaking. How can I help?
Hello. I'm trying to order a sweatshirt from your website, and I've made a mistake. I want a medium-sized sweatshirt in blue, but I clicked on large and red by mistake. What should I do?
Give me your name and I'll take a look. I also need the order number. You can see it at the top left-hand corner of your screen. Then I'll be able to correct it for you.
Oh, that's a relief. Thank you.
Online help desk here. Marcus speaking. How can I help?
Hello. I'm trying to order a sweatshirt from your website, and I've made a mistake. I want a medium-sized sweatshirt in blue, but I clicked on large and red by mistake. What should I do?
Give me your name and I'll take a look. I also need the order number. You can see it at the top left-hand corner of your screen. Then I'll be able to correct it for you.
Oh, that's a relief. Thank you.
Question 3. What kind of shoes is the girl wearing? And what is wrong with them?
Oh, my goodness. I've just made it. For once, the train was on time.
You did have to run pretty fast. I saw you from way back there, and I was worried I'd have to go into town on my own.
Everything went wrong. I couldn't find my coat or my mobile phone. And then one of the heels of my black shoes broke off. That's why I'm wearing my sports shoes. I didn't want to because they're really dirty. I didn't have time to clean the mud off after my last run.
Well, at least you were able to run fast.
That's true. Oh, my goodness. I've just made it. For once, the train was on time.
You did have to run pretty fast. I saw you from way back there, and I was worried I'd have to go into town on my own.
Everything went wrong. I couldn't find my coat or my mobile phone. And then one of the heels of my black shoes broke off. That's why I'm wearing my sports shoes. I didn't want to because they're really dirty. I didn't have time to clean the mud off after my last run.
Well, at least you were able to run fast.
That's true.
Question 4. Where exactly is the bus stop that the man needs? Give 2 details.
Does this bus go to the shopping mall in the town centre?
Sorry, no. This one goes to the station. You need the number 7 bus that goes to the marketplace. Go across the street to the bus stop outside the bank and get the one going the other way.
Thank you. Does this bus go to the shopping mall in the town centre?
Sorry, no. This one goes to the station. You need the number 7 bus that goes to the marketplace. Go across the street to the bus stop outside the bank and get the one going the other way.
Thank you.
Question 5. Which item does Manu have to carry to the car first?
Manu, help me load up the car, please. I've got the camping stuff together here in the hallway, but I need someone strong to carry it to the car.
OK. What shall I take first?
Well, I can carry the red cool box, but could you take the cans of drink? Oh, no, wait. Take the tent before anything else. It's heavier. And then my camp bed, too.
Make your mind up, Mum.
I have. Just do as I say. And, Manu, thanks. Manu, help me load up the car, please. I've got the camping stuff together here in the hallway, but I need someone strong to carry it to the car.
OK. What shall I take first?
Well, I can carry the red cool box, but could you take the cans of drink? Oh, no, wait. Take the tent before anything else. It's heavier. And then my camp bed, too.
Make your mind up, Mum.
I have. Just do as I say. And, Manu, thanks.
Question 6. What 2 football skills can Kevin do well, which could help his team win the match?
Right then. Let's plan what we are going to do in the second half of the game. We're losing 2-0 at the moment, and we've got to win this match if we're going to get into the finals. Kevin, are you listening?
It's useless. We've lost our best player.
No more negative talk, Kevin. We know they're skillful at keeping the ball, but you can easily get the ball from their players. They have a weak defence, and we don't know how good their goalkeeper is. You can kick the ball really hard. And there's no reason why we can't score 3 goals and win. Now come on, everyone. Let's go for it. Right then. Let's plan what we are going to do in the second half of the game. We're losing 2-0 at the moment, and we've got to win this match if we're going to get into the finals. Kevin, are you listening?
It's useless. We've lost our best player.
No more negative talk, Kevin. We know they're skillful at keeping the ball, but you can easily get the ball from their players. They have a weak defence, and we don't know how good their goalkeeper is. You can kick the ball really hard, and there's no reason why we can't score 3 goals and win. Now come on, everyone. Let's go for it.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with Deepa Raj, who works in the Mumbai film industry as a Foley artist, and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to Watch Out, our weekly radio program about films and filmmaking. Today, I am joined by Deepa Raj, who is a Foley artist in one of the largest Mumbai film studios. Tell me, Deepa, what exactly is a Foley artist?
Well, a Foley artist is a kind of sound engineer. You may not realise it, but nearly all the films made in Bollywood in India are made with little sound recording on location. This is the same as in other countries around the world.
Don't they record any sound when they film the scenes with the actors?
Oh, yes, they try to capture the sounds of the actors speaking the dialogue. But there are many reasons why they want to add to the soundtrack afterwards in the studios. There may be a lot of background noise, for instance, traffic, trains, or aircraft noise. The noises on location often spoil the dialogue. So the actors might have to speak in the studio and replace a whole scene or just a few words.
So your job is to record the voices of the actors in the studio?
That is just a small part of it. We have to add to the soundtrack to make it sound more realistic. On a film set, nothing is real. In a sword fight, for example, the swords are often made of plastic. The floor is usually made of wood painted to look like polished stone. The sounds are not convincing, and the Foley artist's job is to replace them with realistic sounds.
So how do you manage to create the proper sounds?
Well, the swords have to sound like metal clashing, so we use metal sticks and bang them together. At the same time, the floors have to echo like hard surfaces, so we drop steel pots onto stone to make loud clattering sounds. We record these sounds and then add them to the soundtrack.
It's like building up a painting, layer upon layer of paint.
Exactly so. We are artists in our own right. Even smaller sounds are added, like clothes flapping in the wind or a fire crackling. We crumple up plastic for that effect. They are what makes the film sound real. If you can tell that the sound is done by a Foley artist, then it isn't very good. It has to sound absolutely natural.
What is the most difficult part of the job?
Perhaps it's making the different sounds of feet. A Foley artist is sometimes known as a walker or stepper, because we provide the sound of all the footsteps in the film. Every footstep for every character. We have to match the steps with the surface. Is it sand? Or snow? Or leaves? We must remember the mood of the character. Is he angry? Happy? In a panic?
That must be really hard. Tell me,
Is it true that you still use coconut shells to make the sound of a horse's hooves?
Yes. Believe it or not, that is still the best way to make the sound of a galloping horse. Two coconut shells, one against the other, one of the cheapest tools in our studio.
Thank you, Deepa. Some interesting facts there for our listeners.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to Watch Out, our weekly radio programme about films and filmmaking. Today I am joined by Deepa Raj, who is a Foley artist in one of the largest Mumbai film studios. Tell me, Deepa, what exactly is a Foley artist?
Well, a Foley artist is a kind of sound engineer. You may not realise it, but nearly all the films made in Bollywood in India are made with little sound recording on location. This is the same as in other countries around the world.
Don't they record any sound when they film the scenes with the actors?
Oh yes, they try to capture the sounds of the actors speaking the dialogue, but there are many reasons why they want to add to the soundtrack afterwards in the studios. There may be a lot of background noise, for instance, traffic, trains, or aircraft noise. The noises on location often spoil the dialogue, so the actors might have to speak in the studio and replace a whole scene or just a few words.
So your job is to record the voices of the actors in the studio?
That is just a small part of it. We have to add to the soundtrack to make it sound more realistic. On a film set, nothing is real. In a sword fight, for example, the swords are often made of plastic. The floor is usually made of wood painted to look like polished stone. The sounds are not convincing, and the Foley artist's job is to replace them with realistic sounds.
So, how do you manage to create the proper sounds?
Well, the swords have to sound like metal clashing, so we use metal sticks and bang them together. At the same time, the floors have to echo like hard surfaces, so we drop steel pots onto stone to make loud clattering sounds. We record these sounds and then add them to the soundtrack.
It's like building up a painting, layer upon layer of paint.
Exactly so. We are artists in our own right. Even smaller sounds are added, like clothes flapping in the wind or a fire crackling. We crumple up plastic for that effect. They are what makes the film sound real. If you can tell that the sound is done by a Foley artist, then it isn't very good. It has to sound absolutely natural.
What is the most difficult part of the job?
Perhaps it's making the different sounds of feet. A Foley artist is sometimes known as a walker or stepper because we provide the sound of all the footsteps in the film. Every footstep for every character. We have to match the steps with the surface. Is it sand or snow or leaves? We must remember the mood of the character. Is he angry, happy, in a panic?
That must be really hard. Tell me, is it true that you still use coconut shells to make the sound of a horse's hooves?
Yes. Believe it or not, that is still the best way to make the sound of a galloping horse. Two coconut shells, one against the other, one of the cheapest tools in our studio.
Thank you, Deepa. Some interesting facts there for our listeners.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with a man who organises an unusual music festival known as the Freeze Festival, and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Music festivals are very popular events in many countries now. They're big summer attractions. But perhaps one of the more unusual ones takes place in London, in the UK, in the winter. And I have here one of the organisers to tell us more about it. Martin Vincent, welcome to our Music News Show.
Hi, thanks for inviting me onto your show.
Martin, for those of us who are not familiar with the Freeze Festival, perhaps you would give us a rough idea of what it's all about.
Right. Well, it's a music festival with a difference. Not only can you go along and hear bands and all kinds of great music, but you can go along and watch skiing and snowboarding competitions, and all in the City of London. The first Freeze Festival was held in the winter of 2008, and now it looks as if it will be a regular annual event. At first it was 3 days long, but it's shorter now, all fitting into a 2-day weekend, packed with activities and fun for all ages.
This is in the City of London, right?
That's right. It's held on a large site on the south bank of the River Thames, a former coal-fired power station where they made electricity, but which is no longer in use. So there's plenty of space. And we need it for the skiing and snowboarding.
Surely you can't depend on London getting large quantities of snow. It may be cold, but not that cold. There is hardly ever any ice, let alone snow. England must have one of the lowest snowfall rates in Europe.
You're right. All the snow has to be man-made.
That must be a lot of snow to make.
You're right again. The area around the power station has to be turned into a skier's paradise, with 360 tons of snow. The main feature of the festival is a huge ramp for the skiers and snowboarders to jump from.
Yes, I've seen videos of that on the internet. It looks huge. How big is the ramp exactly?
The slope is 100 metres long. The skiers and the snowboarders have to travel as fast as they can down the slope at a terrifying 40-degree angle, and then go up the 32-metre-high ramp at great speed, up to 60 kilometres per hour, so they can leap off the top into the air. It takes a lot of courage to make those jumps, and it's fantastic to watch.
I suppose the music must be another major attraction.
Yes, it attracts artists from all over the world, and thousands of people crowd into the enormous tents to listen.
So it's really a festival for music lovers and snow sports enthusiasts.
Well, yes, but there's more to it than that. We have art exhibitions, and there's a great range of shops. Skiing has a wide range of fashionable clothing associated with it, and all the major sports dealers will be there to show off their latest ranges of clothing. So, if you need a woolly hat, or some waterproof gloves, or some stylish sunglasses, this is a great place to come and find them.
It all sounds like a great day out.
There are a few tickets left for this year's festival. Just go online and check out the website, www.freezefestival.com.
Well, Martin, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, but thanks for coming in today.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Music festivals are very popular events in many countries now. They're big summer attractions. But perhaps one of the more unusual ones takes place in London, in the UK, in the winter. And I have here one of the organisers to tell us more about it. Martin Vincent, welcome to our music news show.
Hi, thanks for inviting me onto your show.
Martin, for those of us who are not familiar with the Frieze Festival, perhaps you would give us a rough idea of what it's all about.
Right. Well, it's a music festival with a difference. Not only can you go along and hear bands and all kinds of great music, but you can go along and watch skiing and snowboarding competitions, and all in the City of London. The first Frieze Festival was held in the winter of 2008, and now it looks as if it will be a regular annual event. At first it was 3 days long, but it's shorter now, all fitting into a 2-day weekend, packed with activities and fun for all ages.
This is in the City of London, right?
That's right. It's held on a large site on the south bank of the River Thames, a former coal-fired power station where they made electricity, but which is no longer in use. So there's plenty of space. And we need it for the skiing and snowboarding.
Surely you can't depend on London getting large quantities of snow. It may be cold, but not that cold. There is hardly ever any ice, let alone snow. England must have one of the lowest snowfall rates in Europe.
You're right. All the snow has to be man-made.
That must be a lot of snow to make.
You're right again. The area around the power station has to be turned into a skier's paradise, with 360 tons of snow. The main feature of the festival is a huge ramp for the skiers and snowboarders to jump from.
Yes, I've seen videos of that on the internet. It looks huge. How big is the ramp exactly?
The slope is 100 metres long. The skiers and the snowboarders have to travel as fast as they can down the slope at a terrifying 40-degree angle, and then go up the 32-metre-high ramp at great speed, up to 60 kilometres per hour, so they can leap off the top into the air. It takes a lot of courage to make those jumps, and it's fantastic to watch.
I suppose the music must be another major attraction.
Yes, it attracts artists from all over the world, and thousands of people crowd into the enormous tents to listen.
So it's really a festival for music lovers and snow sports enthusiasts.
Well, yes, but there's more to it than that. We have art exhibitions and there's a great range of shops. Skiing has a wide range of fashionable clothing associated with it, and all the major sports dealers will be there to show off their latest ranges of clothing. So if you need a woolly hat or some waterproof gloves or some stylish sunglasses, this is a great place to come and find them.
It all sounds like a great day out.
There are a few tickets left for this year's festival. Just go online and check out the website, www.friezefestival.com.
Well, Martin, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, but thanks for coming in today.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam.
You will hear part of a radio program in which a woman called Sylvia Short is interviewed about her job. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
Good morning, and today we're continuing with our series on careers for young people. In the studio today we have Sylvia Short, who works for a company that produces guidebooks for serious travellers. Now, Sylvia, I believe you left Essex University with a degree in German and Spanish. Tell us something about how you got your job.
My main interest has always been travel. I spent every holiday when I was a student travelling abroad. After I left university, I spent a year as an English teacher in Spain, followed by 6 months as a tour guide in Italy. When I returned to England, I applied for loads of jobs advertised in the newspaper, but didn't have any success. So I decided to make a list of every company I wanted to work for and write to them directly, rather than wait for them to advertise.
Good advice to anyone, I think.
Yes. And I was very lucky, as the company World Travel needed an assistant in their office in London. I dealt mainly with the post at first, just to get used to their way of doing things. Obviously, I was qualified to do more, but I wasn't in a hurry. Then the manager's assistant announced she was leaving after only being with the company for 12 months, and I applied for her job. The company encourages their staff to apply for higher-level jobs, and I was promoted 4 months after joining.
Good for you. What does the job involve?
Well, I've expanded the role since I took it on. I'm in charge of all the advertising in the press whenever we publish a new guidebook, and I sometimes give talks to people in the travel industry.
Do you find the work interesting?
Oh, yes, it's never boring. We often get odd requests from journalists. They assume we know everything there is to know about travel, so they often ring us to see if we can help them. One rang to say he was writing an article and wanted to know whether there were any female football teams in China.
Really? And what other things do you find yourself doing?
Oh, a large part of my job is to make sure my boss is where she should be. She does a lot of TV interviews on all aspects of travel, and she also presents a radio programme about adventure holidays every Friday night. In between, she writes articles, and now and again comes into the office to find out what's going on there. My job is to keep her fully informed.
What do you think you've learned from working for her?
Oh, she's an excellent writer, and she's helped me, especially when I have to do press releases. She suggests changes, but she's very encouraging, not bossy. She even suggested I did part of a chapter in a new guidebook to Great Britain on my hometown, which I enjoyed a lot.
So, how do you see your career developing?
Well, I don't think I'm good enough to be a full-time writer. But my boss has a lot of contacts in the TV world, and I fancy becoming a TV presenter. However, at the moment, I'm enjoying my job far too much to give it up.
Do you get to go abroad as part of your job?
Not as often as you'd think. I do spend a lot of time doing things like answering the phone, but I did manage to go to the company's head office in Australia last year for a conference. That was terrific.
Sounds to me like you've got the perfect job, Sylvia. Next week we're going to be talking to...
Now you'll hear part two again.
Good morning, and today we're continuing with our series on careers for young people. In the studio today we have Sylvia Short, who works for a company that produces guidebooks for serious travellers. Now, Sylvia, I believe you left Essex University with a degree in German and Spanish. Tell us something about how you got your job.
My main interest has always been travel. I spent every holiday when I was a student travelling abroad. After I left university, I spent a year as an English teacher in Spain, followed by 6 months as a tour guide in Italy. When I returned to England, I applied for loads of jobs advertised in the newspaper, but didn't have any success. So I decided to make a list of every company I wanted to work for and write to them directly, rather than wait for them to advertise.
Good advice to anyone, I think.
Yes, and I was very lucky, as the company World Travel needed an assistant in their office in London. I dealt mainly with the post at first, just to get used to their way of doing things. Obviously, I was qualified to do more, but I wasn't in a hurry. Then the manager's assistant announced she was leaving after only being with the company for 12 months, and I applied for her job. The company encourages their staff to apply for higher level jobs, and I was promoted 4 months after joining.
Good for you. What does the job involve?
Well, I've expanded the role since I took it on. I'm in charge of all the advertising in the press whenever we publish a new guidebook, and I sometimes give talks to people in the travel industry.
Do you find the work interesting?
Oh, yes, it's never boring. We often get odd requests from journalists. They assume we know everything there is to know about travel, so they often ring us to see if we can help them. One rang to say he was writing an article and wanted to know whether there were any female football teams in China.
Really? And what other things do you find yourself doing?
Oh, a large part of my job is to make sure my boss is where she should be. She does a lot of TV interviews on all aspects of travel, and she also presents a radio programme about adventure holidays every Friday night. In between, she writes articles, and now and again comes into the office to find out what's going on there. My job is to keep her fully informed.
What do you think you've learned from working for her?
Oh, she's an excellent writer, and she's helped me, especially when I have to do press releases. She suggests changes, but she's very encouraging, not bossy. She even suggested I did part of a chapter in a new guidebook to Great Britain on my hometown, which I enjoyed a lot.
So, how do you see your career developing?
Well, I don't think I'm good enough to be a full-time writer, but my boss has a lot of contacts in the TV world, and I fancy becoming a TV presenter. However, at the moment, I'm enjoying my job far too much to give it up.
Do you get to go abroad as part of your job?
Not as often as you'd think. I do spend a lot of time doing things like answering the phone, but I did manage to go to the company's head office in Australia last year for a conference. That was terrific.
Sounds to me like you've got the perfect job, Sylvia. Next week we're going to be talking to...
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five different people speaking on the subject of motorbikes. For questions 19 to 23, choose the phrase A to F, which best summarizes what each speaker is talking about. Use the letters only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
There's nothing like getting on a motorbike. It's wonderful. All my life, I've never travelled any other way. I was 11 years of age when I first started on my brother's bike. I had my licence in 1955, and when a company in Birmingham advertised for a test rider, I applied and got it. I had to ride all the bikes they made from 1957 through to 1978, which included hill climbs, reliability trials, and speedway races. After the company closed down, I did trick riding with my brother. We called ourselves the Partners Dare, but by then, of course, it was only a hobby.
Speaker 2. Well, of course, although many people start off with brothers, fathers, or other family members who ride, actually, before you go on the road at all in Britain, you've got to take a basic training course. And that really gets you off on the right foot. Now, after you've passed that, you're allowed on the road. But we, as an organisation, strongly recommend that you take further training. And this may be where Dad can help, you know. Then after that, of course, you're completely free to buy what you like. Go on motorways, take passengers, and just thoroughly enjoy motorcycling.
Speaker 3.
I have a passion for my bike because it takes me away from the day-to-day round of family life as a mother and the problems of that kind of existence. I can just put the key in, turn it, and I'm in another world. And I can be relieved of all the stresses and strains just by riding my bike. Then you may be going along the motorway, and if cars are passing you, you do see the women sort of turn, and you can lip-read them saying, "You look great," or "Well done," and the men always give you a wave in the mirror.
Speaker 4.
The motorbike seems to be an incredibly strong image. This is because it's the perfect form of transport for the individual. You don't have to take account of any other person. You can cut through traffic on a very simple level, but there's also the idea of the unity of mind, body, and machine. It's really the sense of complete freedom, the sense of being completely in control of your own destiny. It's just great fun. You must do it. It's wonderful. You'll enjoy every minute of it.
Speaker 5.
My mother bought me a bike as soon as I had my licence, and she used to ride thousands of miles on the back in those days, and then when I started sidecar competitions, she used to come with me as a sidecar partner. In those days, we did a lot of races together, just for fun. She was wonderful, the same weight as me, so the balance was marvellous, and she used to enjoy it. I don't know what the rest of the family really thought about it, but my brothers are deeply admiring now. Their wives won't let them ride motorbikes, so they look lovingly at mine sometimes.
Now you'll hear part 3 again. Speaker 1.
There's nothing like getting on a motorbike. It's wonderful. All my life, I've never travelled any other way. I was 11 years of age when I first started on my brother's bike. I had my licence in 1955, and when a company in Birmingham advertised for a test rider, I applied and got it. I had to ride all the bikes they made from 1957 through to 1978, which included hill climbs, reliability trials, and speedway races. After the company closed down, I did trick riding with my brother. We called ourselves the Partners Dare, but by then, of course, it was only a hobby.
Speaker 2. Well, of course, although many people start off with brothers, fathers, or other family members who ride, actually, before you go on the road at all in Britain, you've got to take a basic training course, and that really gets you off on the right foot. Now, after you've passed that, you're allowed on the road. But we, as an organisation, strongly recommend that you take further training. And this may be where Dad can help, you know. Then after that, of course, you're completely free to buy what you like, go on motorways, take passengers, and just thoroughly enjoy motorcycling. Speaker 3.
I have a passion for my bike because it takes me away from the day-to-day round of family life as a mother and the problems of that kind of existence. I can just put the key in, turn it, and I'm in another world. And I can be relieved of all the stresses and strains just by riding my bike. Then you may be going along the motorway, and if cars are passing you, you do see the women sort of turn, and you can lip-read them saying, "You look great," or "Well done," and the men always give you a wave in the mirror.
Speaker 4.
The motorbike seems to be an incredibly strong image. This is because it's the perfect form of transport for the individual. You don't have to take account of any other person. You can cut through traffic on a very simple level, but there's also the idea of the unity of mind, body, and machine. It's really the sense of complete freedom, the sense of being completely in control of your own destiny. It's just great fun. You must do it. It's wonderful. You'll enjoy every minute of it.
Speaker 5.
My mother bought me a bike as soon as I had my licence, and she used to ride thousands of miles on the back in those days, and then when I started sidecar competitions, she used to come with me as a sidecar partner. In those days, we did a lot of races together, just for fun. She was wonderful, the same weight as me, so the balance was marvellous, and she used to enjoy it. I don't know what the rest of the family really thought about it, but my brothers are deeply admiring now. Their wives won't let them ride motorbikes, so they look lovingly at mine sometimes.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. You'll hear part of a radio interview with Steve Thomas, a young chef who has his own cookery series on television. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part four.
With us today is Steve Thomas, a 23-year-old chef who delights TV audiences with his imaginative cooking programme. Steve, what's the secret of your success?
Well, I think I'm different from other TV chefs in that I want people to see how I prepare a dish from the word go, so I don't present them with a dish that's half prepared already. If anything should go wrong during the programme, you know, suppose something gets burned, well, that's part of the experience. When they try preparing it themselves, then they'll see the beauty of the finished product, but not on the screen.
So, how did you come to get your own TV series?
I was working in a restaurant called The Gala in December last year when they came to make a documentary about the place. I didn't even look at the camera. I was too busy making pasta and cooking fish. But the producer spotted me and the following week they phoned me to offer me a job. The Gala owner wished me all the best and let me go without a complaint.
Wow. Now, is it true that you come from a family of cooks?
Well, you could say that. I started cooking at the age of eight. My mum and dad have a restaurant, and Dad used to do all the cooking back then. My mum was too busy looking after us. Dad insisted that if I wanted some money, I should work for it. And it seemed a lot more interesting to help out in the kitchen and see how things were made than to earn my money washing Dad's car.
You attended a catering course at college. How did you like that?
At school, I wasn't very good at anything much. At that time, my mind wasn't on anything other than cooking. I found sitting in a classroom trying to pay attention to things very, very trying. I managed to get to college, though, and there I was fine, because when it came to the actual cooking, I knew what I was doing. I realised that a bit of academic work didn't do you any harm either, and I found it much easier when I was interested in the subject. And so I've no regrets, really.
And now you have a TV programme and several cooks working under your orders. How do you get on with them?
Oh, I love working with them. But on my programme, everyone has to be really special. They need to have gone through college training before they even apply for the job. I suppose the problem is that fairly frequently I tend to raise my voice if they don't work efficiently, but I'm just as likely to praise them if they do well.
Yeah.
What I say to them is, you want the audience to say, we are the best, so we need to make a special effort.
Is there any chef celebrity that you admire especially?
I definitely think that Ron Bell is the best, and I'm pleased that he's now got his own food column in a newspaper.
Yeah.
I had the great privilege of working with him for a while. What's so special about him is that he's always been enthusiastic about using ingredients that come from the area where he works. For example, the fish of the day would be the catch from the river close to his restaurant. He's been criticised for sticking to old-fashioned recipes. Maybe that's a weakness, but I think that's his decision.
I heard that you are also going to write a book.
Yes, I'm writing it at the moment. It may disappoint readers who expect a lot of glossy pictures, as most cookbooks nowadays seem to be things to look at rather than read. I've gone for a style that may be less attractive with fewer colour pictures, but it will be more useful for most types of reader. What I say in my book is that we must remember the success of a meal does not depend on how it looks. It's what it tastes like and the company of the friends you'll share it with that matters.
Well, thank you, Steve. I look forward to trying some recipes.
Now you'll hear part four again.
With us today is Steve Thomas, a 23-year-old chef who delights TV audiences with his imaginative cooking programme. Steve, what's the secret of your success?
Well, I think I'm different from other TV chefs in that I want people to see how I prepare a dish from the word go, so I don't present them with a dish that's half prepared already. If anything should go wrong during the programme, you know, suppose something gets burned, well, that's part of the experience. When they try preparing it themselves, then they'll see the beauty of the finished product, but not on the screen.
So, how did you come to get your own TV series?
I was working in a restaurant called The Gala in December last year when they came to make a documentary about the place. I didn't even look at the camera. I was too busy making pasta and cooking fish. But the producer spotted me, and the following week they phoned me to offer me a job. The Gala owner wished me all the best and let me go without a complaint.
Wow. Now, is it true that you come from a family of cooks?
Well, you could say that. I started cooking at the age of 8. My mum and dad have a restaurant, and Dad used to do all the cooking back then. My mum was too busy looking after us. Dad insisted that if I wanted some money, I should work for it. And it seemed a lot more interesting to help out in the kitchen and see how things were made than to earn my money washing Dad's car.
You attended a catering course at college. How did you like that?
At school, I wasn't very good at anything much. At that time, my mind wasn't on anything other than cooking. I found sitting in a classroom trying to pay attention to things very, very trying. I managed to get to college, though, and there I was fine, because when it came to the actual cooking, I knew what I was doing. I realised that a bit of academic work didn't do you any harm either, and I found it much easier when I was interested in the subject. And so I've no regrets, really.
And now you have a TV programme and several cooks working under your orders. How do you get on with them?
Oh, I love working with them. But on my programme, everyone has to be really special. They need to have gone through college training before they even apply for the job. I suppose the problem is that fairly frequently I tend to raise my voice if they don't work efficiently, but I'm just as likely to praise them if they do well.
Yeah.
What I say to them is, you want the audience to say, we are the best, so we need to make a special effort.
Is there any chef celebrity that you admire especially?
I definitely think that Ron Bell is the best, and I'm pleased that he's now got his own food column in a newspaper. Yeah. I had the great privilege of working with him for a while. What's so special about him is that he's always been enthusiastic about using ingredients that come from the area where he works. For example, the fish of the day would be the catch from the river close to his restaurant. He's been criticised for sticking to old-fashioned recipes. Maybe that's a weakness, but I think that's his decision.
I heard that you are also going to write a book.
Yes, I'm writing it at the moment. It may disappoint readers who expect a lot of glossy pictures, as most cookbooks nowadays seem to be things to look at rather than read. I've gone for a style that may be less attractive with fewer colour pictures, but it will be more useful for most types of reader. What I say in my book is that we must remember the success of a meal does not depend on how it looks. It's what it tastes like and the company of the friends you'll share it with that matters.
Well, thank you, Steve. I look forward to trying some recipes.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left, so that you are sure to finish in time. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.